Welcome to the SMA News Today podcast, episode 74. I'm your host, Kevin Schaefer. And today we have a really special episode for you all. Today we have with us one of our own columnists, Katie Napawaki, and with her is her partner, Andy Rush. So Katie and Andy, really excited to have you guys here.
Thank you for having us.
Absolutely. So basically, for our listeners out there, I'm sure you're familiar with Katie's columns, and Andy, you may have gotten an intro to as well through our 31 Days of SMA initiative last August. Andy wrote a really great piece about him and Katie's relationship, and that's basically what this episode is going to be about today. We're going to really dive deeper into that. And so, Andy, I just want to say you did a great job with that piece, and I'm excited to talk with you guys more about your story today. But absolutely. Well, before we get started, if everyone could please listen to a brief word from our sponsor.
This podcast is brought to you by Genentech, the makers of a new FDA-approved treatment for SMA. To learn about our study results across different types of people with SMA, visit approvedforsma.com. That's approvedforsma.com.
Okay, well, Katie, to start off, can you tell us a little bit about your background and how the two of you met? Obviously, for anyone who's read your columns, they know a little about your story. But if you want to just talk a little bit about that, and I know this story, but I'm really excited to hear you tell more about it today.
Yeah, so Andy and I met at MDA summer camp when we were both about 13 years old. We became friends at camp and kept in touch afterward, even though we lived in different cities about 2 hours apart. This was back in the fossil age of like dial-up internet and AOL Instant Messenger. So we, between that and phone calls and periodic hangouts, our friendship grew really strong throughout our teenage years. And we started dating when we were about 19 years old. At that time, I was pretty adamant that I never wanted a partner of mine to be my caregiver. Honestly, it was sort of a horrific thought to me. I wanted to kind of maintain that integrity of the privacy and like the mystery element. You know, I just sort of remember thinking like, well, it's my boyfriend. I don't want him to think that I, you know, use the bathroom like every other human being. So, for that first year that we dated, I really tried to separate my cares as much as I could from him and kind of compartmentalize things. But as our relationship evolved, the threads of caregiving were woven in a little bit at a time in a pretty natural way. So we'd go on dates during the weekends because he traveled to see me and spend time with me. And so I was comfortable with the little things, like while I was up in my chair throughout the day. But then like during formal care routines, especially at night or in the morning, I sort of shut him out. You know, at night, I would ask him to go into an entirely different area of the house so that I could just be with my caregiver at the time, whoever that happened to be, whether it was my mom or a friend or my dad. And I just kind of wanted our spaces separate. But then eventually I started to push those thoughts aside because I wanted that level of intimacy with him. And I knew that if we were going to navigate that together, I needed to start communicating all of the really, you know, gritty, basic stuff that was scary for me to talk about. It was, you know, just things like how I transferred and how I moved around, what motions were comfortable for me or what was painful. So over time, my trust in him grew so much that he ended up becoming my primary caregiver. And then we would just tap into my friends or other caregivers for supplemental help. And I would say at the time that we made that decision, Andy's Becker wasn't really a major voice in that conversation between us because his limitations weren't very, they were more manageable for him.
Sure.
obviously, as the years have gone on, we've had to kind of become more comfortable with having those discussions with each other about how my cares will change in the coming years. But that's basically the recap of the past 15 years for us.
Yeah, that's really cool. It's a really amazing story. And Katie, I love what you said about, the evolution there and how, you were really, afraid to, bring Andy into that part of your life initially, but over time it just became really natural. And Andy, I want to talk, before I talk a little bit about, your caregiving role and how that intersects with you being Katie's partner, can you tell us a little bit, Katie just mentioned the type of muscular dystrophy you have. Can you tell us a little bit more about that and how it affects your daily life?
Yeah, sure. So I have Becker muscular dystrophy, and it's kind of like a less severe form of Duchenne, which is, what more people are more commonly known. I was diagnosed when I was around like 5 or 6, I want to say, and I found that out because I have a half brother who back then would fall a lot, and so he was tested because of that. So because I was related, they decided to blood test me as well, and obviously I had it. Back when I was diagnosed, like Katie said, I didn't really struggle much other than, for example, in gym class, I would do like a half mile run versus a full mile. And so as the years kind of went on, I started to notice differences, like Stairways and I are not friends. Getting up is a bit more labored for me from like the floor, and running from zombies is pretty much out as well.
Darn it. You can rev up Katie's wheelchair in a zombie apocalypse and just like,
It's actually true. Other than that though, I'm still able to do most things like I always have. So just small changes here and there.
I think a lot of it is just little adaptations for you throughout the day and just sort of as you come up to those obstacles, you find different ways of maneuvering and being really flexible.
Definitely.
With how you do things.
Sure. Yeah, I think that's really, anyone in the disability community will, what you're saying about, adaptation and stuff, it's a common theme. And I wonder, too, so, Andy, thinking about back when you and Katie met at MDA camp, A, were you all at all familiar with SMA? And maybe, if you weren't, what similarities and differences did you find as you learned more about SMA?
I didn't really know much about SMA specifically when we met. I was, exposed with my half-brother using a power chair. So when we met at camp, it wasn't really that big of a shock to me, I guess, to see chairs and whatnot. I knew there were different types of muscle diseases under that umbrella, but my specific education, I guess, was basically just with my Becker. I actually also had a teacher back in high school who had limb girdle.
And oh, yeah.
Kind of helped me get exposed more to the different types, and learning, more about the similarities, but also the differences. So most of my learning was through Katie.
Sure, sure. And I didn't know, you mentioned your half-brother, too. Did he have the same type as you of MD?
He does, yep.
Okay, very cool. That's awesome. Yeah, very cool. And also just curious about, I did MDA camp once when I was younger. I was going to go back, but then multiple setbacks happened in the following years, broken legs and sicknesses. And then it just, by the time I was I would have been ready to go back, I had kind of aged out. But I was curious, did, the two of you go regularly to that after you had met, that one year or was that the only year you went?
Well, so that's a really interesting question because I had actually gone first when I was about, 8 years old. I remember being really little, and I grew up in a very small town of about 1,500 people. And I was probably the only, I was the only physically disabled kid there. So I grew up in mainstream classes with kids of normative abilities. And my first time going to MDA camp was really eye-opening for me. I wasn't comfortable with my identity as a kid with a disability.
Mm-hmm.
So I actually didn't end up going back until I was 13 and was just, I don't know, a little bit more, maybe a little bit more open to having other caregivers than my parents.
Sure.
And also just being more willing to make friends. And then, Andy, if you kind of want to tell
your perspective. Yeah, so I actually only went the 1 year that I met Katie.
Uh-huh.
It was kind of odd for me because I was maybe 13 at the time. So again, I didn't struggle much. So I kind of felt almost out of place, like I was taking somebody else's spot in some ways. So it kind of, I think, affected how I felt about going back.
I think it's just interesting to hear how, you know, some kids really connect with it right away and other kids maybe have more questions and need some time to sort of sort out what their identity is with their neuromuscular disease.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's a topic like you and I have both written about before in terms of, I mean, yeah. Like when I went, I mean, I was pretty into, I was like, age wise, I'm guessing like 8 or 9, maybe that year I went. And I enjoyed it a lot, and I had a lot of fun. And then, like I said, there were medical setbacks in the following years. And then by the time I could have gone back, I guess I was about a teenager then. And by then, I was too stubborn. And, like, I was kind of distancing myself from the disability community at that stage of my life. For those reasons you talked about in terms of, like, identity and, like, you know, now I'm very, obviously very proud to be a part of the SMA and disability communities. But at that time, it was something I just, like, quote unquote, wanted to be normal and was more distancing myself. So it's a fascinating journey. And like, that's why it's really interesting, like the two you met at that time, where I think it is a really confusing and overwhelming time for anyone with a disability. And Andy, like you said, I mean, I think that's, I'm sure there are others who can relate to that, because you see in the SMA community, there's a really broad spectrum of abilities there. I mean, there, you see at conferences, people with type 1 who are on ventilators, and then there are people who with type 3 that are ambulatory. And so there's this like really broad spectrum, and I think that's something to be celebrated, not, you know, discouraged. But I imagine that, you know, at that age, it's hard to really, like you said, you may have felt that like, oh, am I taking someone else's place? Because like, I don't really need caregivers at this time. And so it's a really interesting perspective, and I appreciate you bringing that up. But yeah.
Of course. I mean, I had a great time, though. I mean,
sure.
I met Kate, so.
Yeah. It worked out, right? Yeah. And also, before we go to a break from our sponsor, but I have to imagine many of the conversations you had at the camp were nerd-related, and I imagine, like, that was probably a thing that brought you together, if I'm not assuming.
Yeah, absolutely. a lot of music conversations and
nice.
Similar interests, and I think, too, just knowing that even though Andy wasn't using a wheelchair, even though he had what, you know, a lot of us would refer to as an invisible disability,
mm-hmm.
It was comforting for me to know that he had a brother who used it and he had that exposure.
Right.
It just made me comfortable that there was that sort of unspoken understanding between us.
Absolutely. I mean, I can imagine that adds a whole layer of just like, it's not like you were, while there was, I'm sure, plenty for him to, like, learn about, like you said, he didn't know a whole lot about SMA, but having that perspective, just, like you said, I think I could relate to that. I mean, it would make it so much easier to have those conversations. It's not like you're bringing someone who knows nothing about the world of disability into your life. It's like, you know.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's true. Absolutely. Awesome. Well, before we continue, if everyone could listen to one more brief word from our sponsor.
This podcast is made possible by a sponsorship from Genentech. Are you living with SMA, or are you a caregiver for someone who is? A new treatment has just been FDA approved based on studies of different types of people living with SMA. Genentech extends a special thanks to all of the individuals, families, and healthcare providers who participated in the studies that led to making this new treatment option a reality. To learn more about this new treatment, visit approvedforsma.com.
All right. Well, Katie, you talked earlier kind of about the evolution of Andy becoming your caregiver and what that was like and, you know, getting over the anxieties of that. What it, thinking about it now in the present, in what is it like having him as your full-time regular caregiver?
You know, there's so many different words that come to mind.
Mm-hmm.
I would say it is ever-changing. It's rewarding. It's humbling, visceral. And to be honest, sometimes it is challenging in the regard that all relationships are challenging. You know, I think between two people of normative ability, it requires ongoing present effort. And then, you know, you throw two muscle diseases and caregiving into the mix, and it just really becomes a party. So, and I mean that in the best possible way.
Sure, sure.
We have to remain aware of the climate of our relationship and kind of keep a finger on the pulse of our life together. We have to have the hard conversations with each other so that we can try to balance each other's well-being. I think the most challenging times for us as a couple have settled in when we stopped having those raw, honest conversations. But, you know, I think at the end of the day, it always brings forth a closeness and a bond that's truly unique for us. And I would also use the word interesting because, you know, historically, caregiving roles and stigmas in our society are often thought of as like extending feminine energy to masculine energy. You know, so it's not as common for a male to readily be considered as a prime candidate to be a good caregiver to a female partner. But I do think those perceptions are slowly kind of being disheveled and deconstructed. And I'm really happy to see that. I'm happy to see that male partners are being portrayed more as like absolutely capable, compassionate, attentive care partners.
Yeah. No, I'm really glad you mentioned that, actually, because I read Ben Matlin's book, his last one, a few years ago, that was about interracial couples. He's an author with SMA, and he was talking about that exact point about how, like, you know, if there ever is a portrayal of interracial couples, it usually is, you know, the male with a disability and the female as the caregiver. And right. Of course, not that there's anything wrong with that. I mean, it's just, but it's yeah. For a long time that it's like that was kind of the only representation. And like you said, I think it's so important to, you know, broaden that perspective and, you know, make people realize it's not just that. There are plenty of, you know, and you're a great example of, like, you know, even more diversity in that you both have different disabilities and, you know, you're able mm-hmm. to work through that. And so I think that's really important.
Yeah, I think it's important to have the discussions around just human to human care versus yeah. like, does it traditionally have to be female, male, or, I mean, I think even seeing more male healthcare workers has been really encouraging. And I know when I was a kid and even recently, if I've been in the hospital, there are a lot more male caregiving roles within healthcare. So it's just something I'm happy to see that's changing a little bit more with perceptions in our society.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you also brought up, you know, kind of like aspects of like the hard conversations. And Andy, you can answer this too, because I want to get your perspective on the same subject. But, you know, I was watching a video on Squirmy and Grubs recently, of Shane and Hannah, and they did one about, like, you know, answering the question of, like, okay, what happens when we have a fight? Because Hannah is Shane's primary caregiver. And, you know, like, do they storm off? And then, like, what happens when, you know, if they have a fight, does Shane get his care and all that? And they gave a really nuanced video about that where, like, they said, yes, of course we have fights. We get, you know, really angry at each other and it happens. And they said in their case, like, they're usually able to work around it and kind of, like, settle those arguments before, you know, like, Shane needs to go to bed or go to the bathroom or whatever, you know, and they're able to work through that. But I'm just using that as an example to say that, like you said, there have to be those hard conversations and those nuances when it comes to caring for someone with a disability while also being their romantic partner. So, Andy, do you want to talk about some of that? Just what are some of those nuances and what's it like, your perspective as a caregiver and a romantic partner to Katie?
Sure. So, you know, just echoing what Katie said, those difficult conversations, you know, are always going to be important for us. you know, we have to respect each other's space, even though we do the cares. Before Katie, I never had really done caregiving, so it was kind of a learning curve for me. But I think as we progress in our relationship, I think we are finding that we need to communicate even more. You know, we need to set necessary expectations for each other as far as both caregiving and our relationship, so that, you know, we try to balance it and keep them as separate as possible. But obviously that sometimes gets blurred a little bit.
I think too, if I can just interject, a thought I had about when you mentioned the arguments, sometimes you have to have those situations occur until you know what you're doing wrong in them and what you need to improve on in the future together. And, you know, they are messy sometimes, and then you have to look back and be able to sit down together and say, okay, this was uncomfortable, this wasn't healthy, so how do we make sure we move forward in a really healthy way? Do we have, you know, certain words that, I mean, we were talking about recently, just having a word where if we're one of us is getting overwhelmed, what can we say that we need to just signal to the other person that we need to take a break and just have a little bit of space together. And Andy, of course, with his wicked wit, a pickle stamp. So pickle stamp is our new word.
Oh, I love it.
And so, you know, you just have to kind of, you have to sort of, like I said, for lack of a better word, just allow each other to mess up a little bit and then revisit the situation and make sure you move forward in a really healthy way.
That's great. That's great. And I think that leads perfectly into my next question, which is, like, what are some of the joys that come with being in an interabled relationship? Something that, you know, is, you know, different from a lot of relationships, but also similar. I think that, you know, that word you just came up with is a perfect example. But yeah, if either of you can speak to this, just, like, what are some of the, like, nuances and the joys that come with, you know, having this unique kind of relationship?
Sure. I think there's definitely a lot of high fives in our relationship. You know, we're always kind of trying to incorporate humor wherever we can, because that's been a coping mechanism for us. I do think a lot of the joys that arise are more from, like, our bond together and just that natural bond that sort of occurs when two people are in a romantic relationship together versus specifically being a derivative from, you know, having the interabled aspect of it. But it absolutely does keep us both grounded, and I think it allows us to channel creativity and innovation on a pretty regular basis.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. Andy, go ahead. Yeah.
Literally, yeah. Like, figurative high fives and actual high fives. That's, you know.
Nice.
But yeah, we like to travel and do, you know, outdoor stuff. So I think some things we like to enjoy is finding accessible places that work not only, you know, for Katie's chair, but also some of the limitations that I have, and just having a unique perspective because we both have those limitations, you know, helps, you know, us see the world a little bit differently, I guess.
Yeah.
And,
yeah,
you know, we kind of call the closer parking spots rock star parking. So that's obviously a perk.
That's great. That's great. And just wrapping up here, by the way, this has been a fantastic conversation, and I really appreciate both of you sharing your perspectives on this. But thinking too about, and I imagine this looks different now because of the pandemic and everything, but what does a typical day look like for each of you? So Katie, you can start just kind of like with writing and with others. What is kind of like just walk us through a typical day of the week for you and Andy.
Yeah, so morning cares begin before work for both of us, of course. So then, you know, after morning cares, we're in our own spaces pretty much throughout the day. We do reconvene at different points for cares, but it's usually agreed upon times. Often the night before, we're sort of running through the schedule of the next day, or even on weekends, we're kind of going through the schedule for the week and just hitting on those high points of what we need to make sure we're doing differently for cares, if there's like appointments mingled with work and everything else, how we're gonna tackle all of that for the week. Evenings for us are usually kind of a mix of us doing our own hobbies and having our own spaces, but also spending time together and just doing the fun stuff so that we can have that bonding time too. I do have another caregiver who helps us throughout the week a little bit, and she's also available on weekends if we need overnight care. So that's been really helpful because we can have that scheduled time away from each other to make sure that we do have the very necessary breathing room. And I think that would also bring me to talk about the biggest challenge of the past year and just sort of trying to get through this pandemic and being around each other so frequently, combined with less physical contact with our family and friends. You know, there's only so many red shells in Mario Kart that we can throw at each other. It's as hard as it's been. It's been one of those mountains that we've had to tackle with each other and have open conversations about, even what the future looks like for us. And now we're at a point where we definitely want to grow my care team so that we have more options. And it has been a hard year, but it's also encouraged us to take a look at some of the things we maybe weren't looking at every day right away. It's been so much of just like putting our heads down, getting through the day, doing what we have to do to get through all of this, this chaos that's been so prevalent, you know, throughout the past year. And sometimes you just end every day like slapping a gold sticker on your chest and feeling like, yeah, I did this one. We got through it. It was good. You know, but then you stop having the conversations about what you're really feeling and what's going on. And there's feelings lurking. So it really is good to check in with each other once in a while and be prepared to show up if one of you says, you know, something's not really working for me. We need to kind of come up with a plan and be able to adapt.
I think with COVID too, like everybody probably assumes that, oh, we're around each other all the time because Katie needs cares, but you know, we're noticing too that there were times that I would be away and that's kind of taken away. So it's kind of opened up new conversations that we've had to have as far as space and giving each other, you know, that respect that we both deserve. And
absolutely. I mean, I think that's, I think anyone in the past year, whether they're living with, you know, their spouse or partner, family members, friends, whoever, it's a huge lesson in adaptation. And I mean, we're all in this boat together, but yeah, like you said, I think those are the biggest things you can do is like, you know, congratulate yourself for getting through another day and also recognize the feelings that you're all going through and just kind of take it day by day. But also, you know, think for, you know, hope for a better future and work toward it as well. So that's great.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Very cool. And last question is just, Katie, you can start with this, is just what advice would you have for others in the SMA or just the disability community in general who might have those anxieties about dating and relationships? Like, what would you say to those individuals?
So I would say first that those anxieties are completely natural. Mm-hmm. I still feel it in various ways. And I have anxieties about what the future will bring for both of us. I found that I cope better when I connect with close friends or mentors about my worries and fears. And even if they're not people who have a disability, they can still offer some really great advice and just be a sounding board. I think in our relationship, we've never really colored inside the lines, and that's helped us to be open to adapting in a life that works for us. So I would say don't be afraid to explore a lot of different options. Again, kind of the I think the theme of this whole conversation with you, Kevin, has been kind of don't be afraid to have the hard conversations. So I would reiterate that again. And don't expect it to always be easy, but know that your hardships together will help you grow into better people. And I think if you can always feel that beauty and love in your connection together, then you're golden.
That's great. I love it. Andy, anything you want to add to that from your perspective?
Yeah, I was just going to say that, you know, I think everybody has worth, and it's, to me, it's just really a matter of finding the people who want to see you thrive and win and surrounding yourself with those people, whether it's, you know, romantic and dating or just friendship. And, you know, I think it's important to recognize that this community is a lot bigger than people realize.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, Andy, Katie, I want to thank you so much for coming on today. This has been fantastic. And this is also a really good time to announce that. So obviously, Katie has her column on SMA News Today, which you can check out on Thursdays. But Andy, do you want to tell listeners out there what you'll be writing very soon?
Sure. I'm going to come on as a columnist for Muscular Dystrophy News Today. So we'll see how it goes.
Oh, I'm sure it'll be great. I'm really excited. Looking forward to that. For our listeners, MD News Today is one of our sibling sites, all under our publisher, parent company, BioNews. So I am really excited to have Andy writing for us very soon. So we'll have more. Just check on that site as well. You can find it, you know, in the coming weeks. So awesome. Well, Andy, Katie, again, thank you so much for coming on today. And for our listeners out there, you can find more stories like this by subscribing to this podcast. You can also check out all of our various platforms on SMA News Today. We're on Instagram, Facebook, YouTube. We have flash briefings. We have our forums community. And you can find everything on our main website at smanewstoday.com. We would love to hear from you. So thanks, everyone, for listening, and we will see you next time. Take care.
The information in our flash briefings and podcasts are provided for informational and educational purposes only. Be sure to tune in daily to SMA News Today for the latest news and perspectives regarding the disease. Discover more content that might be of interest to you at www.smanewstoday.com, and be sure to follow us on social media and join our SMA News Today forums, a trusted SMA community ready to welcome you anytime.